You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Those of you don't know Susan Crawford, I don't know who wouldn't know Susan Crawford. She's now at the University of Michigan Law School, where she actually was in 2008, but left for the Obama transition team, and then worked in the White House, the president, special assistant to the president for science, technology, and innovation policy. She went back to Michigan. She was on the board of ICANN. She was the founder of One Web Day. Just a ton of accomplishments. Let me introduce to you Susan Crawford.
Thank you very much. Okay. So my job is to provide you with a crisp, provocative, and entertaining panel about net neutrality. That will be easy because of the cast we have here. Hal Singer from Empiricis and Michael Livermore from the NYU Institute for Policy and Integrity, and we've got Markham Erickson from the Open Internet Coalition and Christopher Yu from the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to start with a well-moderated Jim Lehrer-style debate between Mr. Singer and Mr. Livermore. We're going to assume the results of the last panel are taken as read, that in fact adoption is possible, that it's a good idea, that Secretary Clinton's breakthrough internet freedom speech last week shows us all that the internet is important for human rights, economic growth, for small businesses all across the world. And we're going to assume that the status quo to date has been that end users pay ISPs for internet access. Seems right. Yeah. And the content providers, in turn, pay their ISPs to upload material to the internet. And the question presented to the FCC in its net neutrality proceeding is whether ISPs should be permitted to charge content providers for access to subscribers. That's a second payment made by content providers to make sure that they can reach the subscribers of the internet service provider. So I think all of you know this, but just in case there's some stranger to telecom world in the room, the FCC has drafted a net neutrality regulation codifying its 2005 policy statement and adding a couple of things, a non-discrimination principle subject to reasonable network management and not applying to managed services, so lots of definitions to be worked out there, and a transparency principle. Today, we are focusing on non-discrimination. That's all we're going to talk about, and we're going to assume that, as Justice Scalia said in Brand X, the FCC has the authority to promulgate rules like this. Okay, so the question of authority is not part of this debate for today. We're talking about non-discrimination, and we have two questions for this panel. First, the effect of the proposed net neutrality rules on innovation and investment for both infrastructure and content. So that's the subject of the debate between Mr. Singer and Mr. Livermore. And then, as Tim said, we've got tens of thousands of pages. The question presented for us is, where are we? I just went to a conference on meta information where the question was really, where are we and what are we talking about? But the question for this one is more specific. Where are we in terms of the net neutrality proceeding at the FCC? And we're going to rely on Markham and Christopher to help us through that. But let's start with the debate. And I have asked Mr. Singer and Mr. Livermore to lead off with no more than 2 minutes, you know, as if they're explaining this to their aunt, why their position on net neutrality, its effect on investment in particular, makes sense. And I want to start with Mr. Singer. So 2 minutes. I'm watching the clock, and I am Jim Lehrer. Go
ahead. Okay, by way of a very quick background then, the FCC has proposed a form of price regulation on certain transactions in the internet space. In particular, the FCC wants to constrain the price for priority delivery offered by a broadband service provider like Verizon to a content provider like Sony at a price of zero. Now, I've been asked to address the narrow question of what net neutrality means for investment. The problem with this question, however, is that it presupposes that there is a need for regulating the price of priority delivery in the first place. Most economists who have examined this issue, along with the Federal Trade Commission, have concluded that in the absence of market power among broadband service providers, markets can generally be relied upon to produce the right price for priority delivery. Now, to get around this standard requirement for government intervention, the FCC's NPRM offers a novel collective action theory as its basis for setting the price at zero. Everything that I say about investment effects in the 2 minutes that I've been allotted presumes incorrectly that the FCC's novel collective action theory makes economic sense, it does not, and that it applies here, it does not. Now, the net neutrality crowd likes to say that without a zero price restriction for priority delivery, innovation at the edge of the network would decline. This is bogus, and it is also uneconomic. Now, the FCC has designated Black Dyna Chocolatier, a bonbon maker from Maine, as the poster child of the upstart content provider who would be driven into bankruptcy without net neutrality regulation. In reality, Black Dyna could care less about some priority delivery arrangement between Verizon and Sony that would support Sony's online gaming service. Black Dyna would continue to make bonbons and broadcast its tasty creations to the world as if nothing had happened. Indeed, no one other than rival online gaming portals would even care about such an arrangement, and even they would only be interested if the terms extended to Sony were not extended to Sony's rivals. To tell a tale about threatened innovation at the edge of the network, net neutrality proponents intentionally conflate fees for prioritization, which can't possibly drive Black Dyna into bankruptcy, she would decline the offer, and termination fees, which could affect innovation at the margin. But their proposed remedy, zero prices for priority delivery, does not match the alleged problem, protecting innovation among content providers. Now, on the other hand, preventing Verizon or AT&T from offering priority delivery at a positive price to the Sonys of the world would discourage investment by both broadband service providers and content providers. Sticking with my example of the online gaming portals, why would a game developer toil away in his basement if he thought that end users would never get to experience the game as he intended because of some rule that barred his contracting with a broadband service provider for priority delivery? Ironically, net neutrality would harm the very folks it seeks to protect. Now, to understand why net neutrality undermines the investment incentives of broadband service providers, one first must understand what happens when you tell a two-sided platform provider that it can no longer raise revenues from one side of the platform. Well, the answer is that it tries to raise revenues from the side of the platform that's not regulated, which are end users. But the problem, of course, is that end users are more price sensitive than content providers, and as a result, this means lower expected returns for the service providers, not to mention lower penetration rates from higher broadband prices. And lower expected returns means less investment. I'm on my last paragraph, don't I?
Okay. Very short. Let's
Good.
Finish this.
This is the punch. This is the real kicker.
This is the poetry.
Yeah. In a forthcoming paper with Bob Crandall of Brookings Institution, we estimate that broadband service providers invested on average $28 billion per year from 2003 to 2009 to build the first generation networks, and those investments supported 430,000 jobs in the U.S. economy. We also show that broadband service providers plan to invest another $30 billion per year to build the next generation or second generation internet access technologies, and those investments will support 500,000 new jobs. Of course, those projected investments and associated jobs depend on the regulatory environment. If the FCC starts meddling with the prices that broadband service providers can charge for priority delivery, some portion of those investments will be put at risk. And while the FCC, Free Press, and Google might not care about investment at the core of the network, I hope that someone listening today recognizes the importance of these planned investments, especially in a very weak economic recovery.
Thank you so much. Mr. Livermore.
Yes. All right. Thanks very much. I think that raises some of the key issues. One, just to start, is a valid question of, is government action or what, is there some market failure here that we should be worried about? And clearly, in the internet context, and there's some fairly broad agreement on this, is that there is a market failure and that there are provision of positive externalities from the internet. Information, there are network effects as well. And so those are two types of market failures that at least kind of a priori could justify the government taking some steps. Now, positive externalities are a consequence when the folks that create value in an economy cannot capture all of that value. So that happens all the time on the internet. Content providers and broadband providers are generating value and only capturing some part of that. Now, that's a good thing at some level, but it also creates an economic problem, which is systematic underinvestment. So you're going to have underinvestment across the entire internet. And so this underinvestment is an innovation problem. We're worried about innovation. Underinvestment at the core is a problem, and underinvestment at the edge where innovation is happening is also a problem. So we need to develop some kind of strategies to overcome these positive externalities if we want to achieve anything that looks like an optimal level of investment in the internet. So where does net neutrality fit into this? Basically, what and we did an analysis of this recently at the Institute for Policy Integrity, is one of the concerns that you have is that net violations of net neutrality can result in wealth transfers from content providers to broadband providers. That's kind of the setup. That's part of the reason that ISPs are interested in this. And then, of course, there's nothing wrong with that at from the perspective of these firms, naturally. We're worried about the social consequences, though. And so if we're seeing a wealth transfer from content providers to ISPs, that can exacerbate this problem of positive externalities, where content providers are already subject to a problem of an inadequate return on their investment. And so the question is, how do we deal with this? On the content side, net neutrality is a way to protect the return on investment for content providers. And on the broadband side, which we also recognize is subject to the same kinds of problems, infrastructure is a much better candidate for government support than content. Now, a standard economic solution to a problem of positive externalities, there's several, but one of them is government subsidies to make up for that shortfall in of investment. So if we're going to be, if the government's going to be involved in this game, then subsidizing content is extremely difficult. We've tried to do it in other contexts, in television, there's the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but these kinds of things can't be done on the scale necessary to overcome the problems that we face in the internet context. Whereas in the infrastructure context, there's a long history of the government successfully subsidizing infrastructure. And so broadband is a much better candidate for that kind of government action. And so a pricing rule that protects content providers' return on investment to ensure that they have adequate incentives to invest in innovation and new technologies, and at the same time a system of government support to overcome positive externalities in the broadband context, we see as being the best kind of suite of solutions to the problem of systematic underinvestment in the internet. Maybe I could return to a couple of the points that were raised, too. So on the content side and on prioritization, and I think that it's important to separate out the issues of fees for prioritized service versus termination fees. And so they are distinct, although they have some related aspects.
Could I ask you to pause there so I could bring out some of this questions to both of you? So back to Mr. Singer. How do you respond to this very interesting point about systematic underinvestment in content and this idea that perhaps the transaction fees for small businesses that might be created in the absence of a net neutrality rule will undermine investment in content? What's your reaction to that?
Well, it's an interesting story. When I read stories like that, like the FCC's collective action story, and then this new theory that would possibly motivate government intervention, I'm reminded of a term that my mom used to use in Yiddish. It's called Bubba Meinze. It's kind of full of crap. I've never heard of such a thing. Let's keep it high minded.
Yeah.
But economists, you put an economist in a room and you lock the door, you can come up with a lot of crazy ideas and motivations for government intervention. What is upsetting me is that no one's attempted to try to go out and show that any of the conditions from these models apply to the real world. I mean, to what extent are we underinvesting in content? How do we know that? Every time I turn on the internet, I'm inundated with content. What is the measure of the underinvestment? By how much are we underinvesting, and how do we get it going? I mean, if that's the problem, my God, let's do subsidies for Google,
okay,
a tax write-off.
Mr. Livermore, how do you respond to the carrier's assertion that investment will be stymied? That investment will be stymied by the presence of a net neutrality rule, and that you know, we've just heard from the last panel we really want to encourage private investment. So what's your response to their argument that we're getting in the way, potentially, with government intervention?
Right. I actually think that, you know, there's a trade-off involved. And I think that folks in a debate can sometimes think that, you know, that there aren't trade-offs involved, that if we took their position that the world would be beautiful and that there would be no cost to that. And I think, of course, in this debate and in other policymaking arenas, there's always costs and benefits to either side. And so in this context, we like to look at the costs and benefits of a net neutrality rule. And we recognize that there are some trade-offs involved. And so what we talk about is that trade-off between content providers and the broadband network. And so and we recognize that both face systematic positive externalities. And so you have this problem, it's prevalent throughout the entire internet. And so the question is, how can you address it in these different contexts? And that's where we're looking at government and saying, what can government do? And noticing the difference between infrastructure and content. And it is very hard, as Hal mentioned, to actually go out and for the government to go and write checks to Google and say, Google, you're doing a great job, generate more content. We really don't want government in that business. Whereas government in the business of facilitating greater broadband access, greater infrastructure, that's something that we think governments can do fairly well.
Okay. Hal, before you respond to that, I have another question for you.
Right,
I
want we'll
to
get
these,
each really, face
these high points, which are, okay. There have been some assertions that, in fact, investment in infrastructure on the network side is declining in a deregulatory area as a percentage of revenue, and that we can't expect that vertically integrated carriers will actually invest more in their networks in the absence of a net neutrality rule. Is it your assertion that that's true, false? What would you say about that argument, which gets made?
I wouldn't make a forecast based on the trajectory of investment. I would appeal to just basic finance theory, which says that if you lower the expected return on an investment, you will see less investment.
Okay, Mr. Livermore, right. You want to respond to that?
Sure, and that would apply equally the same to content providers, right? That's the whole point. There is a trade-off involved here, right? So if we reduce the return on investment for content providers, we can expect less investment. If we reduce return on investment if we take away the ability to increase return on investment for broadband providers, we can expect less investment than you might otherwise see. But the point is, how do you make up, again, I'll just return to that same point, how do you make up for these shortfalls? And, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, we have to worry about content. We can rob Peter to pay Paul, but both are faced with positive externalities. There's okay. Uninvestment in both, and it actually doesn't make sense.
Okay, Hal, I can see you want to respond to that. So what do you think?
What I'm struggling with, and maybe Michael can help me out, is how would allowing a contract between Verizon and Sony to support Sony's online gaming portal reduce the expected returns for Sony or Black Dyna or for Imperius or for the Washington Post? Just explain that to me.
Sure. So you're talking about I assume we're in agreement that termination fees are a bad thing.
Well, I'm not going to...
Before we begin the colloquy here, I want to actually keep this a little formal because I get to, because I'm standing up and you're sitting down. So let's say, are you really suggesting, Mike, that content needs to be subsidized? Is that your position here, or is that an oversimplification of what you're suggesting?
Well, I think that, I wouldn't characterize it as an oversimplification. What I would say is just that it faces positive externalities, and we want a way to overcome that. Mm-hmm. A direct government subsidy is one way. There are lots of ways that you can potentially overcome it. We're saying that net neutrality is one way that you can at least help overcome the positive externalities.
Okay, and Tal, I want to ask you, businesses often want certainty. Wouldn't the presence of a net neutrality rule actually provide certainty for investment, or are you saying it goes the other direction?
Well, from whose perspective? The content providers or the...
No, actually the infrastructure provider.
No, the infrastructure. I'm just going to go back that if you force the infrastructure provider to raise all the revenues mm-hmm. on the one side of the market that's most price sensitive, you're going to lower the expected return on the investment, and that is going to lower the investment. It's just that simple.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Mike... What are the harms that have led to the need for government intervention here?
The harms of positive externalities.
I'm talking about a harm that someone can point to and say, there's a harm. I mean, have you met a positive externality? I wouldn't know if it stood up in my soup. I wouldn't know a positive externality.
Right.
So,
right.
What are the harms that lead to?
I mean, we're talking about, I mean, it's true. These are abstract principles that we're talking about at some level, right? And so it's impossible to say, well, this is a company that would have otherwise existed. Right, and the other thing is, of course, we operate under a de facto net neutrality regime. So to point to the harms of not having net neutrality is very abstract, right? Because we're talking about a harm to a potential situation that does not actually exist. I think what we're talking about are the kinds of things that we're talking about are genuine concerns of if we move away from the de facto net neutrality regime that we have in place. And again, it's difficult to grab hold of that and to show it to you. But we can say that content provision across the board faces positive externalities. So one case is, a clear example is, journalism faces positive externalities. They produce, they generate information, it produces all kinds of benefits for society, and they only capture some small part of that. Now, that's just an example. Google generates positive externalities. All these firms generate positive externalities. And so if you start to take away their revenue and put it in the hands of other people, they will have less incentive to invest in those things. And so the next Google, I mean, the way that people talk about it is to say things like, I don't know what the next Google is, nobody knows what that is, but it might not exist under an alternative regime.
Okay, Hal, so that's a pretty sharp point. So what you're doing is shifting the possibility of future revenue away from content over to infrastructure. Would you say that mischaracterizes the argument?
It does. Look, he uses the term wealth transfer as if this is something evil or nefarious. Whenever I buy something, I buy a car, I buy a house, there's a transfer from Hal's bank account to the supplier's bank account, but I am better off as a result of the transfer, else I wouldn't have done it. Now, if Sony wants to go buy a service from AT&T so that Sony's online gaming portal will run the way that Sony wants it to be, by God, let them do it. Who's harmed in that process? Black Dyna doesn't want that service. The Washington Post doesn't want the service. I don't want the service. Why would we care? How would it affect our returns if you allow an efficient deal to occur that makes both parties to the transaction better off, regardless of a wealth transfer?
Let me interject a question here. Mike, how much does your point of view depend on the existence or not of competition in the infrastructure market? Does that matter for government intervention?
Just to quickly say, I don't think wealth transfers are nefarious. I don't think profit maximization is a bad thing. I think it's a wonderful thing. But I also think that having rules of the road, and you know, that also makes sense. Now, to return directly to your question, no, our argument does not hinge on competition problems. Competition problems might exacerbate some of these concerns, but it doesn't hinge on competition problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's their new line, and that's the line in the FCC's NPRM. They lay out the collective action theory as the basis for intervention, and then they say to the extent that there is market power in this market, these speculative harms would be exacerbated.
All right, Mr. Singer, but isn't it true that there could be lots of social goods that are, you know, good for the rest of us that the infrastructure carriers may not recognize in the way that they run their networks? So there's some sort of baseline social rule needed for transport of communications.
Well, what I hear in the question, I don't know if you're asking this, is that possibly they can't trust themselves to charge the right price for priority delivery because they're so selfish about collecting these QoS revenues that in the process they'll end up deterring entry and content, and that will infect. Yeah, I've heard this story. This is kind of the collective action story. What's funny about this story and why it makes no sense is that if it were true that all the internet service providers, broadband service providers, could get into a smoke-filled room and recognize that if they could just get together and coordinate in a conspiracy on the price of priority delivery, that the optimal price is zero, right? And they would be better off, as the FCC suggests in its NPRM. If that Bubba mindset were true, then why aren't they supporting net neutrality? This would be a perfect way to lock in the profit-maximizing price for QoS, which the FCC asserts is zero. But clearly, they don't believe that. They're against net neutrality the last time that I checked.
Let me lower the temperature here a little bit and ask about applications that might require less latency or jitter. Ask Mike about this. Certainly, that's been the assertion that the network as it stands, the status quo, discriminates against applications that require better treatment in order to function well for the public. What's your answer to that?
So we're talking about the applications that would benefit, some of them we're talking about applications that would benefit from prioritized service, right, or that can exist now. So in our report, we discussed prioritized service as a little bit of a distinct problem. And in that context, I think it's fairly clear that there would be some firms that would enjoy additional surplus from a prioritized scheme. That's actually not, we don't contest that. Others might contest that they would benefit. The issue with prioritized service is that while some firms benefit, other firms are worse off. And so you basically take the internet as it currently is experienced, and you where content providers enjoy a large degree of surplus, and you break it off into kind of two tiers where some content providers might be better off, other content providers are worse off, and ISPs are kind of taking a chunk as well. And so it's what we say is that it's not unambiguous, that there's plenty of, it's just uncertain what would happen in that situation. And what we kind of say is that the problems are, there are problems with ISP incentives. If ISP incentives were perfectly aligned with the market, if there were no positive externalities, you didn't have these kinds of problems, then we might not have to worry about it. But we do have competition problems. We have the existence of positive externalities and so on. And so ISPs will, in fact, face perverse incentives to set the price point incorrectly, to manage the network in lots of ways that will harm the folks that aren't in the prioritized service. And so, you know, of course we can come up with an example of somebody who might benefit from this. I'm not contesting that, right? But that doesn't say whether on net, overall, society's going to be better off. And so that, I think, is not the issue. It's not fighting examples, oh, my Google versus your Sony transaction. It's looking at it systematically, what's best overall for society.
So, Mr. Singh, are you assuming a perfectly efficient, omniscient ISP that can make all the right decisions for society?
No, and they don't need to be. I'm asserting that market forces are sufficiently competitive such that if left to their own devices, each broadband service provider would choose the right price for prioritization. Mm-hmm. You know, Michael keeps saying that someone would be worse off, but I'm struggling trying to figure out who is harmed in my hypothetical transaction between Verizon and Sony. Who is harmed as a result? I want to know.
Let's let Michael answer that.
I haven't heard
that.
I'm
going to ask for wind-ups from both of you. So who is harmed, Michael?
Well, okay. One example, and again, I fight this idea of like the one example that we're that's the lens through which this policy should be examined. But in this example, a hypothetical party that's harmed is the provider of service who is a new entrant into the marketplace, who doesn't have the capitalization to compete in that context, which we experience all the time in the internet. Now, if we had perfectly efficient capital markets, you might say, well, then they could get access if their idea was so wonderful. Yes, but we think in the internet context that, you know, we like to have those folks on the edge have access to a general open system that they can compete on equal terms with the big boys, right? And if you let the big boys get the priority service, you're going to drive those folks away.
Okay, Hal, last question for you. Can you conceptualize the absence of a net neutrality rule as a trade barrier? What if you're a little company in another country that wants to reach U.S. subscribers and can't make that arrangement with Comcast or Cox or Verizon or AT&T? Aren't you upset? Don't you go to the WTO?
No, it wouldn't happen. The way that I understand an arrangement for priority service is that this has nothing to do with access to the U.S. market. See, this is a point I made earlier. What net neutrality proponents want to do is conflate prioritization service with some access or basic toll road, okay, to the internet. That's not what we're talking about here. This is if you already have access, if you're already online, you already have access to all of Comcast customers, but now you just want to buy an extra service to make sure that your application can run in real time. We want to make sure the market produces such an offering and does it at a positive price. What we should be striving for is a quality of opportunity. Right? So if some rival wants to take on Sony, I want it to be able to go to the Comcast and AT&T of the world and say, let me buy that because I want my application to run with the same integrity as Sony's application.
Okay, it's been very tough on Christopher and Markham not to be saying anything. We want to bring them in. So just a wrap-up couple of sentences in the opposite direction. So first Mike and then Hal and then we'll go over to Christopher and Markham.
Right. So I guess just to wrap up, again, I think that it's important in this debate to remember that there are trade-offs, right? There are trade-offs for any policy. The idea that we can just select one policy and that magically everybody's better off and nobody's worse off is a complete, it's a little absurd, right? That's just not how policymaking works, that there are trade-offs. And the question is, naturally, on the aggregate, for society, for the internet as a whole, how do we maximize this value? There are good reasons to think that net neutrality, as a suite of policies, will do that. It helps overcome well-recognized failures in the internet market, which will, over time, systematically lead to underinvestment across the board. There's good ways to deal with that. Net neutrality is part of that. Is part of that answer.
Thanks, Mike. Howe, you want to wrap up?
Sure. Well, every time I hear the justification for net neutrality, it changes slightly, and every time it's less and less compelling. If there is a real problem here about underinvestment in content, then let's do something about it. Let's give a tax credit to all content providers, including Google. I don't want to see a policy embraced that generates a bunch of harms just so that we can achieve this end. But net neutrality would do exactly that. Net neutrality would destroy a bunch of very efficient arrangements between content providers and broadband service providers to enable their applications to run the way that they were intended to.
Okay, terrific. Thanks to you both. And now I want to ask Markham to first respond very briefly to this point that net neutrality will destroy efficient arrangements between content providers and network access providers, mm-hmm. and then say your two-minute summary of where we are in the net neutrality docket, and then we'll ask Christopher.
Right. Well, we get into a little bit into this. I mean, there's a debate about whether you view this whole ecosystem as a two-sided market at all, or whether it's more of a multi-sided market, or as Professor Economides says, it's a billion-sided market. And so we actually think the way the internet ecosystem works now is actually relatively efficient in that the inefficiency is for the ISP at the user end to reach all the way across the internet to the content provider, say YouTube, and try to work out a deal for delivery to the endpoint. Instead, how it currently works is I pay AT&T for access to the internet for a certain amount of capacity. AT&T gets that payment. They're also getting paid by the transit provider that is terminating the content provider's communication to me. So they're being paid twice on that end. And then there are many, many different hops where peering arrangements and other sorts of arrangements for that communication to be transferred until it gets back to YouTube. And the same on YouTube side. YouTube pays somebody like Level 3 to get access to the internet to deliver the content all the way down to AT&T. So the problem with the AT&T trying to go back to YouTube and saying you should pay this to terminate the content is YouTube is at an as informational disadvantage. And if AT&T doesn't feel like they're actually being compensated enough for that traffic, then they either ought to charge the user more, or they can also go to their peer and say, look, too much traffic is coming our way, and we're going to have to revisit our peering arrangement. And that can go all the way back to the YouTube point where each one then charges more and more and more, and you have a perfectly efficient marketplace. That's sort of how the system works now. To say that somehow AT&T should jump across all those players and charge YouTube for essentially a tax to terminate that content, I think, is an inefficient marketplace. So I just want to make that
So
point.
Let's assume you've read 50,000 of the comments.
Yeah.
Where are we? How are things going? If you're an FCC staffer, what would you go tell your boss today?
So I think you're seeing over the comments a lot of crystallization support for, in general, for the four principles and the transparency prong. So the internet policy statement, the transparency part of that, except for the fact that the large providers are saying that there's no authority to actually for the FCC to actually enforce all of that. But then they're saying if there is authority to enforce all of that, it ought to be applied to jurisdiction across the entire internet ecosystem, to the content providers, the Googles, the YouTubes, to the Akamais, every part of the internet ecosystem. So it's sort of a strange argument in that regard. And then there's a lot of disagreement about the definition of non-discrimination, and then a lot of disagreement about whether it's a strict non-discrimination or sort of a reasonable or unjust non-discrimination standard. And then the final point is the comments are all over the map on what reasonable network management is. And, of course, the carriers want just a reasonable standard with extreme flexibility And I think others would argue for something that's a little bit more strict, some intermediate scrutiny standard on how networks manage their traffic. But a lot of agreement on transparency, a lot of agreement on the four principles, just not agreement that the FCC has the authority to turn those into rules and make them enforceable.
Okay, Christopher, anything the comments that leapt out at you, let's say unusual suspects, people that you weren't used to hearing from, something that you found remarkable?
The real issue is not the people we didn't hear from, because at 60,000 some pages, you heard from everyone you expected to.
Okay.
The story
I
is the people.
I was just trying to come up with another.
No, but the story is the people you heard from you didn't expect to. Now, what's fascinating is if you look at granted, there's some 450 submissions, and this is not some great in-depth analysis, but first, tremendous number of small chamber of commerces from small towns, from small businesses in small towns, and from a lot of minority organizations from all over the place. What's interesting is just looking at the A's, Arab American Chamber of Commerce, American Association of People with Disabilities, Alabama AACP, Atlanta Business League, and the like. First. Second, this is my read. I don't want to get into the quibble over the numbers, but my read is that it's 75%+ opposed the non-discrimination rules and network neutrality. 14-ish% supported it, and 10% took no position because they were interested in fighting piracy or something that wasn't central to it. I think people can quibble with the exact numbers about categorization, but I think one of the big surprises is the docket came in surprisingly overwhelmingly opposed to network neutrality based on the overall comments. I think it's a bipartisan issue. 24 state representatives filed, all Democrats. I think 5 or 6 mayors filed, all Democrats, all opposed. What else would I say? And what's really interesting is the reason these small-town chamber of commerces and minority organizations came in is they actually do see the link between network neutrality and build-out. They're saying that if you can't use network management to lower the amount of bandwidth that you have to provide to provision a neighborhood, you're going to provision fewer neighborhoods. And that is uniformly the concern expressed in there. And that draws the connection that's been played in the question, the first panel and in the discussion over here between Hal and Mike. Now, what else I would say is there's a sense that my read of this is that there's also a different change here, which is we're moving into a different phase of build-out. The first phase was leveraging legacy investments. It was DSL and cable modem service, and it was relatively cheap, like on the order of $500 a subscriber. We also got a fiber glut build-out, which was not a good thing, but we really enjoyed the benefits from. It wasted a lot of value, but we had a lot of dead capacity. The next generation of the 100-meg internet's costing a lot more. Fios, the estimates are 4,000 to 8,000 a subscriber, 10 times more. The good news is the wireless of 3G plus and 4G rollouts seem to be cheaper, but they still seem to be more substantial capital upfront investments than is required by provisioning DSL and cable modem service. So the need to generate real revenue to cover this, I think, is a real one. And then the other thing that I would say is that there is a danger, I think, that the way the debate's being framed is they say, look at the internet as it's been to today, and they're sort of looking at the internet of the past and looking at its successes. And it reminds me of one of the criticisms that people have made of AT&T in the old days is they didn't get it. They were too hypnotized by the past network and look to the future. It's a very good argument that that may be happening now. The internet as we know it today has a layered model. I think everyone here understands that, and that's very good at encouraging competition within the layered system. So if you're operating within a layer, that's great. There's a different kind of innovation where you need a different structure. And that is the trade-off here, that in the sense that those are the kinds of innovation that the current structure is not good at. So let me give you 4 or 5 examples of things that every engineering professor will say the internet as we know it today is not good at. One, multicasting. Sending one message to lots and lots of people. You basically have to, if you want to send out 100,000 messages, you have to send out 100,000 duplicate bits. So if you're sending one message to the same message to 100,000 people. Hey, wouldn't it be great if we could send one set of bits to the first hop router and have that split it off as necessary and have the acts come back and aggregate in a better way? Second thing it doesn't do, mobility. Basically, on the IP internet structure, it doesn't support it well. Third, security does not handle very well. Fourth, what I would say is cloud computing and different architectures that don't have an end-to-end model. Fifth, internet video. Interactive video, I would say, not pre-recorded. As long if it's truly interactive, all of a sudden we have not only a bandwidth problem but a jitter problem, and the internet as it exists today doesn't do it very well. And the fourth, the last thing I would say is change. It's interesting that I can actually cite about a dozen engineering professors who are saying, how do we transition to a new internet? And this is the National Science Foundation's Gini project and their FIND project and DARPA's NUARC project. And there's all these initiatives who actually think that this layered structure we're in, we're stuck. And that, in fact, there are innovations that depend on a different approach to networking. And that right now, because of the installed base exacerbated by the fact that we're stuck in a certain number of layers, is preventing us from getting there. And so there's a wonderful question, and I would agree with Michael when he says it's not clear whether we're better off or not. I would say that if we believe in Julius Genachowski's commitment to database decision making, if we don't know whether it's good or bad, I think the burden rests on the people under that approach who want to regulate to show that the data is there to prove it. But not only that, what strikes me is if we really don't know which way to jump, keeping the existing framework is equally ambiguous. Isn't that the textbook time where you wouldn't want to intervene, because you can't tell if it's ultimately ambiguous which way it's going to fall? Because it's easy to do potential harms, and what we've learned from competition policy, if you regulate in terms of potential harms, there are a dozen potential harms we can all think of, and then all of a sudden we lose the experimentation and people never find out. And maybe what we should do in the ambiguity is, to me, I would agree with that. There is an ambiguous case, but that cuts the other direction than I think what Michael suggests.
Mike, I want to bring you back in here, because there are two quite different mindsets, I think, being shown here. Christopher's talking about vertically integrated systems. Your vision has been more of a platform on which heterogeneous development is taking place, and a trade-off between that development and the platform. What's your response, what's your reaction to Christopher's view of the modern internet as I think he's trying to present it?
Again, I think that, you know, you can tell kind of stories about what potentials that we could get out of a non-network neutrality regime, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that some of them are very attractive stories. But the question isn't whether there's some potential for positive good. The question is, again, on net, whether we think that those kinds of potentials, if they are realized, justify the risks that we're facing on the downside. And just to kind of crystallize the ambiguity here, you know, we say that there's some ambiguity, because there's always ambiguity in these kinds of situations. We don't know which way the market's going to go. It's impossible to make predictions. No one knew that the housing market was going to blow up the way it was. Prior to that, you know, there was ambiguity. Maybe it was going to go up. Maybe it was going to go down. People don't know. But, you know, there are good reasons when you look at the incentives that ISPs face that this will not get, the way it will shake out will not be a positive story, that the surplus that gets destroyed when we move to these alternative arrangements will be greater than the surplus that gets created. So I think that that's the way we look at the issue is overall, not whether there's some potential for somebody to make out better or for some alternative arrangement that is beneficial for some folks, but again, whether what we are losing whether what we're gaining is sufficient to justify what we're losing.
Appreciate that. Markham, Christopher has said that the vast majority of the comments seem to be militating against net neutrality. Is that your reading of the comments? I mean, none of the rest of us have had a chance to read everything, so we're looking at you two as messengers to us of what you've seen.
Yeah, I actually haven't had a chance to break it down like that. What I've seen, though, is if you include the public sector and sort of non-institutionalized comments, that actually breaks much more in favor of pro-net neutrality rather than against net neutrality. But I haven't broken down the ratio of positive pro comments versus negative comments. I know that some of the comments that are negative are a lot more voluminous in terms of page numbers.
And what do you take from that?
I take it from it that the network operators, the broadband providers, for them, despite the fact that they are saying that they are for more openness and more open platforms, this for them is something that they will fight very vigorously over, the potential rules that will take potential revenue stream away from them down the road. They just don't want to take that off the table, the possibility of future revenue from charging content providers or doing other systems, quality of service arrangements that create new revenue streams.
Okay, well, we've had some terrific colloquy here, but it's your chance. So, questions, Mark.
For Hal Singer.
And say who you are.
Mark McCarthy, with Singer. I thought your comments were great. They really sharpened the issue. Back to the Sony example, should Sony be able to sign an exclusive with the carriers so that all their actual and potential competitors are cut out of the market? And so, would this be a problem? If there is a problem there, shouldn't there be a rule that would require the same kind of service to be made available to all potential competitors with similar terms and conditions?
That's a great question. Before I answer it, I should also note that I, too, am a professor at Georgetown University, so something in common. This issue about exclusivity is really where I think the debate should go. In fact, I submitted comments with Bob Lighten and Bob Hahn in the net neutrality proceeding, and I think that what we should care about, if anything, is the prospect of exactly what you said, the idea of foreclosing a Sony's rival from having access to the same quality of service. But this is a very different concept of discrimination than the one that is rolled out in the NPRM. What I'm advocating is for equality of opportunity. That is to say, if a Sony rival wants to get the same package of quality of service from AT&T or from Verizon, I want it to have access to it and on the same terms. Now that by itself wouldn't be all you'd need to show for intervention. I'd want to show a few more things like market power and that the disparate terms were made on the basis of affiliation. But I lay out about a four-part checklist for this. But you're asking the exact right question.
Does anybody else want to respond, Mark?
I was just going to add sort of three points to that. The first is whether a network operator can provide quality of service to Sony or Xbox is highly dubious because, again, we're talking about a network of networks where the end provider is dealing with a content provider at some other different point. Theoretically, the network operator can provide some sort of quality of service within that user's node, that network, but whether they once those packets get into the public internet, they can't do anything to prioritize those bits. So there's a technical question of whether it's feasible. The second is what we call the prisoner's dilemma problem, which is that even if you allow Xbox and all the other gaming providers to get the same terms, what you'll end up doing is you create the fast lane where everyone that has the means will buy into the fast lane, right? So their services actually don't improve relative to their competitors. They're all essentially at the same speeds. And, in fact, the network operator will simply just increase their prices to stay into the fast lane without actually improving service. And then the companies that can't buy into that stay on the slow lane. And then, finally, there's no incentive for the network operator at that point to invest in their network because they want to create the fast lane. They want to keep Sony paying those fees. So they're not actually going to return those profits into investing into the infrastructure unless we want to have a rule that forces them to take those profits and put them into network investment.
Okay, lots of questions out there. So, Christopher, very short, then I want to go to another question.
What's interesting is, I'll skip one thing I was going to say. The one other thing I would say about exclusivity is a lot of the debate is framed in a world which is about the internet was originally email and file transfer, person-to-person communications. Right now, it is a world of mass communications. And when you actually look at that, then you have First Amendment implications and another thing that we haven't raised here. And there's a very active debate about how those cut, the most vocal of which is saying, in fact, the First Amendment, as we understand it, is a limit against government action. But what strikes me, and not against private action, which is textbook law. The one thing that strikes me, though, is a lot of people have this idea that we're going to have an unintermediated internet, and that's the virtue of it. In an avalanche of content where I can't crawl the network every night to find out what news out there, I'm going to rely on some intermediary to tell me what happened last night, whether it's an email I get in my inbox from a newsletter I subscribe to or a search engine. And the idea is there is a free speech implication, and in a deficit of attention world, exclusivity has a role in that because it's regarded as a potential First Amendment benefit as well because that means making choices.
Okay. Other questions out there? Yes, in the back row.
Jeff Daly, AppRising.com. I just want to make a quick comment and a question. If I was a policymaker in the audience right now, I'd be really frustrated because it seems like whichever way I step, I'm going to destroy the internet as I know it. I'd be really frustrated. So I want to ask the question, is there any potential for a third way? Is there a way we can craft policy that can support innovation both at the edge and in the network?
Okay, so Hal and Michael, this is for you. If you're stuck in a back room.
Sure. You want me to go first?
What's the deal? What's the deal that it
Sure,
is?
Sure. I think that the middle way, and it's the thing that I proposed in my comments to the FCC, is, for God's sakes, allow the contracting to occur, number one. But number two, if you're worried about potential harms, make sure that those terms are made available to any comers who want access to offer the same service and want to do the same thing with the same quality of service. I think that's the middle way, and that's something that I could be talked into.
Okay, Michael, so what's your response to that?
Well, actually, I think that the FCC is pursuing something of a middle way, which is that they're kind of moving slowly. They are, you know, this is not a huge rule. They're presenting broad principles that are going to get fleshed out. There's a couple of mechanisms for them to kind of have let the pressure out and allow for some you know, for some flexibility going forward. So I think that that's actually the right method. And I also, for what it's worth, do think that we'd like to have a middle way, which is that you have some mechanism to protect content providers, but at the same time you have the government through direct support, targeted support, ensuring that we're getting investment in broadband as well.
Okay, Christopher, quickly.
I actually think that there is a third way, and we're not that far apart. Markham and I are supposed to be opponents. I actually agree with most of his core recommendations. He's advocating an ex post case-by-case regime. We differ a little bit on how the burden of proof would be in terms of that, but that we're pretty close. He acknowledges that things like differentiated services and prioritization regimes would be okay. I actually think that's a huge step forward and a positive thing in the debate. My only caution would be is there's a bunch of new prioritization initiatives. Ones have been around, explicit congestion notification. There's a new gloss on it called REECN, which is being brewed around. There's another one about giving worse than best effort service coming out of the ITF called LEDBAT. And I don't want to get too hypnotized by the language of DISSERV, because that's not the end of our innovation in terms of how we can engineer the network. We just have to make sure that it's not just DISSERV that we can continue to grow with this.
Okay, so it's in the back of the room now, be in the front of the room. Please identify yourself.
Hi, Larry Spider from the Phoenix Center. I have a question for Michael. You talked about positive externalities people don't invest in. Okay, fine. What do you do if the externality is a negative externality? What do you do if it's congestion? Then what happens?
So congestion is a very important issue, and that is definitely part of the debate. So on the congestion issue, there's a variety of different points where congestion can arise. I assume that what you're talking about is in the ISP's kind of last mile network. And in that context, the way that we see it is the appropriate point to place that that price control is on the end users, right? Because they have the best information for making decisions. So if congestion is really a problem in that context, then changing the price structure for end users is the appropriate way to go, rather than this alternative model where you're kind of trying to reach out to the content providers alternatively as a way of trying to price the congestion issues.
The retail prices should go up.
I disagree with that, because the problem is one end user doesn't know what the congestion is, because it depends on what other people are doing as well. It only the network person who can actually see all the flows coming in can really know whether it's congested or not, because it's like what's going to happen on the freeway when you drive out there. Well, you have to know what everyone else is doing, and an individual end user doesn't have that information. I actually thought you were going to ask a different question about negative externalities, which is there is also content that many people regard as antisocial. Whether it's, there's no dearth of porn on the internet. There's other things. And even if I were to buy, I actually think externalities are ambiguous for a lot of really boring academic reasons that I wouldn't want to go into, but even if I accepted Michael's proposition, it doesn't lead me to a general network neutrality rule, because not all content has positive externalities even plausibly, and if that's the case, we'd end up with a targeted rule which would probably run afoul of the First Amendment almost certainly, and be much more, it wouldn't lead to the kind of network neutrality rule that's currently in the NPRM.
Okay, Michael, and then we're going to have one more question and then a little sentence from our panelists, and then we'll be wrapping up. So go ahead, Michael.
You know, that's actually a very interesting point about the potential negative externalities or the potential negative problems with content. Again, I think that on balance, of course, that we both agree that that the internet's a good thing, it's good that there's content out there, that most of the content is going to tend towards positive externalities to the extent that it's out there. And we're in exact agreement about the government's not in a good place to try to differentiate between those two things. That's why we see that's why we, on our side, kind of see reason for a broad rule that protects content. You know, obviously we disagree about that, but I think that there's quite a bit of agreement there as well.
Okay, last question. So in the middle of the room, yes, please go ahead.
Morgan Reed with ACT. I was interested that you talked a lot about the NPRM and how it sets up the debate. But when we went through our review, paragraph 106, I think it is, defines anti-discrimination and talks about all the things that shouldn't happen. And then it's almost as though the FCC went, whoops, and paragraph 108 creates this exemption rule that says all the wonderful technologies we should be trying to promote. In fact, I started realizing that it felt like if I were to put a pipe to your house that had 10 megabits in it, I have 5 megabits I'd sell you as internet access, and then all my quality of service and new technologies I have to call not the internet over the same pipe, over the same transmission rate, and that would become my specialized services under 108. How do we change that feeling on the NPRM? What can we do to get it from a fear-based NPRM to saying these are the technologies in 108 that we want to promote? And oh, by the way, when there are bad actors, we'll put a boot on their neck and step back on it. Okay. So really, that dichotomy.
Markham hasn't said anything for a little bit. Markham, sure. You want to help respond to that? What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, the rules themselves, I think, don't foreclose the ability of innovation within the network and for different sort of quality of service arrangements that are pro-consumer. I think the way we view this as looking at the rules through the consumer's eyes, right? And so as long as those arrangements are, the decisions are consumer-driven, consumers get the choice about what kind of applications or what kind of services that they want to see have prioritized treatment or services that they want to make sure are terminated to their place that get to the front of the queue rather than that may be time-sensitive, latency-sensitive, we think those would work within the current rulemaking. But I think it's an area that we all have to tread carefully in as well because of we don't want to create incentives for network operators to promote scarcity as a way of creating new revenue streams rather than investing in their network. And you know, finally, I'd say, despite for 15 years, as long as we've had the public internet, people saying that the congestion issue is something that was going to crash the internet that had to be looked at and we had to figure out how to put investment into the internet. Internet content and the investment in the infrastructure to deal with that has roughly kept pace evenly over the last 15 years. And so there's really no empirical evidence that there's going to be so much congestion coming down the pipe, even with internet video, that the network operators are going to have to get into very granular network management practice to be able to deal with those congestion things.
Okay.
And there's been some good studies on that.
That's terrific. Well, everybody, take a deep breath, and we're going to look the policymaker in the eye and give our wrap-up point that you really want to put across as a result of this panel. So, Hal, you started us off. You finish us up.
All right, I always have to go first. I think that the question actually teed up the right way to think about this. There's two paths that we can go down. One is that we ban everything and then force the broadband service provider to come forward and prove that he's an exception to the rule. And the other choice is that you tolerate this sort of contracting and you put the burden on some complaining party who claims that they've been unfairly discriminated against. To me, the answer is clear, and I think we might have consensus, at least 3 out of 4 on the panel, about where to go. Now the question is, what are the conditions that a complaining party would have to show in order to prove that the discrimination that they claim is, in fact, anti-competitive? If we can agree on those conditions, we might be able to get to the finish line and still be friends.
Okay, Christopher, look the policymaker in the eye, wrap up.
I'll look the policymaker in the eye. The one thing that we did not discuss here was wireless. And it's one of the things that the people had charged us to talk about, and we just never got to it. So I'll use my time to say that.
Okay.
Wireless operates on fundamentally different principles. In fact, wireless devices don't even have IP addresses. They work through an IP gateway. And in fact, I don't know if you saw the Wall Street Journal article. In fact, different wireless networks are on GSM and are trying to upgrading the 3G platform and trying to save money instead of 4G. So we're going to have a very heterogeneous world. I'm not even going to start about the differences in congestion management on wireless and all the different things. There are very, very different aspects, and lumping them together is hard. I also will give one cautionary note. Before we get too alarmed by potential horror stories, those of us who lived through the AOL Time Warner merger in 2001 remember all the stories stories about how it was the end of history. And as it turns out, all it was the end of $200 billion in shareholder value.
Okay, Markham, is this simple or complicated?
Simple. It's well understood the Internet's been an incredible economic engine for economic growth, for jobs, and for speech. And the question before us is the Internet, do we need to enact rules that preserve the remarkable nature of the Internet to help our society engage in all of these positive things? We think that simple rules are necessary now for two basic reasons. One is that the network operators are going to be increasingly competing with content providers that compete with their own video cable offerings, right? So things that are coming down the pipe from companies like Netflix and Amazon, from YouTube, are going to be increasingly going to be in a position of competing against the network operators' own content. So we don't want to see the network operators be incentivized to manipulate that content in a way that forecloses that competition. The second is, unlike 4 or 5 years ago where Ed Whitaker said his famous statement that sort of launched the whole network neutrality debate, back then there really wasn't the technology to allow the network operators to inspect people's content, manipulate the data, and do bad things. Today, that content, that technology not only exists, but it's being actively promoted at trade shows with slogans like, if you can see the content, you can monetize it. So this really isn't a debate about network management. It's really a debate about whether at this point, before that starts being ubiquitous throughout the system and Wall Street starts expecting those returns, those profit returns that are very then hard to shut off, whether we say at the front end, we as a society aren't going to allow that to happen, and we're going to continue to let the Internet be this remarkable engine of growth that doesn't allow network operators to turn the network Internet into something that looks a little bit more like cable television.
And Michael, tell the policymaker about spillovers.
Right. So the thing that we need to remember with the Internet is that, you know, we want to increase the value of this entire system. And so there can be a tendency for the broadband operators to be against the content providers and for us to kind of, for folks to try to win in one sector or the other. But ultimately, it's the kind of ecosystem as a whole that we're all trying to preserve. And so we need to understand that within this ecosystem, we need to make sure that all of the parties are given the appropriate incentives to invest in innovation and at the core. And to do that, rules that help preserve content providers' returns while at the same time using the government targeted support for broadband is a good kind of all things considered approach to getting that ecosystem that's been running so far pretty well to continue running and also to, you know, let a million flowers bloom.
I want to thank the panel for a very interesting hour and thank all of you.